Hello, everybody. Welcome back to my podcast. I think the perfect way to start an interview with somebody you don't know well is after a protracted period of silence. Talal wanted to record just some room atmos, for editing purposes. So Tom's been here for a little while. We haven't really.
Just staring at each other.
Yeah, and we've had to sit in silence for 20 seconds. So, and now we have to, explore each other.
And there's a drill in the background.
Personalities, so. And there's a drill in the background, as usual. That isn't my neighbour for once, constantly rebuilding cars of Sisyphus. I think it's in the street.
Trying to be professional.
Yeah, no, it was. It's, from a recording point of view, it's absolutely professional. It's just socially awkward.
Well, excuse me.
That's all right. So my guest today is Tom Mayhew, a young comic. As usual, I pride myself on having done no research whatsoever, really, apart from looking for a bit of looking at your work on YouTube. But Talal says lovely things about you. And you like me, so that's all he told me you like me anyway, maybe he's lying. So that's all I need, really. So I don't know. I mean, just where's your place in the comedy firmament, really? Where would you say how'd you get into it? Where do you see yourself now? Where do you see yourself going? What's comedy about these days? Explain it to me, because I don't really know, because I'm too old and too wealthy, and all that, really, so go.
I'm sorry, Tom.
No worries, man. Thank you for hosting me for this. I feel like I'm on Terry Wogan, to be honest, right now.
Yeah, Terry was very similar, kind of. Yeah. Terry could often go quite meta.
He would do, yeah.
And I don't think I ever did. I don't think I ever did Wogan. I've done Parkinson.
Did you?
Yeah, and a friend of mine, Muriel Gray, bet me that I couldn't get... No, I had to say slippers, tartan slippers, at some point during my interview. And so I did, and then I told him, and he got really upset. I told him afterwards, and he got really upset.
What do you mean, like he was literally in floods of tears?
Not in floods of tears, but you could see he wasn't pleased that I'd been playing games. He thought it was towards the end, towards the end of Parkinson. I mean, that's when I tend to get, if I do these things at all, it's towards the end when they've fallen into a kind of late Roman Empire kind of decadence.
You like to be the final nail in the coffin then?
Yeah, well, it's not that I like it, but that's by the time they get around to me, that's where they're at, really. And so, Parkinson, his glory days were well behind him.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
If you ever have Alexi on your show.
I mean, is this going to be the end of my career now?
No, it doesn't work. I don't have that kind of reverse. I can't say that I have. This is mostly me talking at the moment, isn't it? I can't say that I necessarily have a beneficial effect on people's careers. I don't have a sometimes I have a magical. I mean, obviously, there was something. The all-new Alexi Sayle show, second series, for instance, had unknown actor called Christoph Waltz in it, who later went on to be double Oscar winner, and also fairly unknown actor Peter Capaldi on it, who also later went on to be Doctor Who and so on and so forth. So, we can... Sometimes I have the golden touch, but sometimes I don't.
So as a relatively unknown comic, that's no pressure for me, right? I've just got to try and be Doctor Who or win two Oscars.
Yeah, but you've got a few years to do.
Oh, yeah. Right, I'll try my best.
Yeah, yeah, no rush, though.
But yes, I'm a comedian. I'm 30. I'm one of the young, up-and-coming comedians who is quite left-wing, and so that's probably why I like your work, because I was literally thinking about this on the way here, how in terms of someone who has had a political viewpoint and stayed the same consistently since the early 80s and worked in the same field and really put the effort in, you're basically the comedy Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah. Says I've got a nicer house. Well, I'll go with that. I think I'll take that, really. We love Jeremy here. So how did you get into being a comic, I suppose?
I just really loved comedy as a teenager. I didn't really like... other kids liked music. I really liked comedy. And I really liked how you could talk about your life, but also talk about important shit while making jokes. And I think that's the really cool thing about stand-up is how you can talk about the big topics, the big issues, the important things of the day, while also... you know, calling someone a wanker at the same time.
So what sort of stuff would you be listening to? Were you watching or listening to, I mean, when you were growing up kind of thing? What was your...
I mean everything from The Young Ones. Have you heard of that?
That's a little show. Yes, it's a little show I think I've heard of. Yes, I do think he was very innovative. I don't really get the checks anymore from DVD sales, but...
But also, you know, Blackadder and lots of good stuff. That's old stuff.
How would you watch that? I mean, this may be a stupid question, but I mean, you're 30. Would you be watching it kind of in a non-linear fashion, or would it be in DVDs and shit?
Well, I guess I would first watch it when it was repeated on telly,
right?
Because we couldn't really afford many DVDs, so I would just watch it on telly, and I wouldn't be able to watch it consecutively from the start, which is probably a good thing with Blackadder, I guess, because the first series notoriously is not good.
Yeah, I quite liked it. Yeah,
but I mean, it's probably all right, just not as good as what it grew to be.
Well, it was sort of different, really, because
different old show altogether. Yeah.
It was just Richard Curtis by himself, and it was, but there was some funny, it was weirder, really. But obviously, John, I mean, one of the Oxford lot who I do have some time for is John Lloyd, really, who was the producer of that. And I think he saw that Richard needed somebody to...
Oh. You know.
So, yeah, he was the one who got Ben in.
Oh, right. Oh.
And
I never knew Ben Elton didn't have anything to do with the first series.
Blackadder, no. Oh. But that's, I mean, it's considered the shitty first series. So, you know.
Yeah.
No, I mean, Ben was brought in and it immediately got better, really. But I also think it's because Johnny Lloyd was also... He wouldn't let either of them get away with just submitting first drafts and, you know, made them rewrite and rewrite and rewrite really before. And you can certainly see a decline in Richard Curtis's output from when he got too big, you know, when people stopped. Oh, this is completely off topic, isn't it? But, I mean, when he got started directing and producing his own films as well was when he really went. When, I mean, he was, you could always think he was pretty bad, but he got worse when...
He sold out.
Yeah, I don't think he ever sold it. Anyway, I'm sorry, I'm digressing again.
It's all right, man.
Is that interesting comedy? Are you interested in that kind of comedy archaeology?
Yeah, I'm proper like comedy nerd.
Yeah, I think that stuff. You see, there's only me who knows that stuff in that way, really, because I was around when they were doing the first series.
I mean, you created comedy. You've said it.
I did. Yeah. It started out as a joke, you know, as a semi joke, as kind of under my, you know, I used to do it when I first came back to stand up in 2012. I said, you know, I used to do this joke about, you know, a lot's changed since I invented alternative comedy, and it was a kind of mocking. It was a joke mocking my self-importance in a sense, while at the same time, but now I've come to believe it, really. You know, it's become, I've got no sense of humour about it. I'll just completely, completely believe it and get annoyed if anybody questions that there was anybody before me doing anything. And
which is a great joke in itself.
Yes, I suppose so.
Become...
I just forget that. Yeah, it's just like, we were talking before we started recording, but I've just taken part in a documentary about the Edinburgh Fringe. And you rightly say, you said to me, Tom, what did you say to me?
That you invented comedy in Edinburgh, I said, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But you said, well, I was doing it to make the point that I invented comedy.
Yeah,
in
yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it was a, you know, yes, exactly. So not only did I invent comedy in London, you know, in Britain, but I also, I started that. I was the first person to do modern stand-up comedy at the Edinburgh Fringe.
And now documentaries seek you out to ask you what it was like to be the one who invented
exactly. And I enthusiastically do them because I have to, you know, I have to constantly promote that story, really. Yeah.
Did you ever get nominated or win the Comedy Award?
No. No, I didn't.
Absolute disgrace.
It is. Well, I wasn't, in all fairness, I didn't really... Yeah, I think the year I invented comedy at the Edinburgh Fringe, which was 1980. I think it was like maybe the first year of the Perrier, and they fucking gave it to Cambridge Footlights. I mean, for fuck's sake.
I mean that.
Yeah.
In a way, nothing's changed.
No, exactly.
That's the big issue at the moment, is how classist or Edinburgh Fringe is, isn't it? Lots of people are talking about how it's very hard for anyone working class to get into Edinburgh.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, basically, the any reason that people would know who I am is because I did a show in 2019 called I, Tom Mayhew, which was about when I was on benefits when I left school, because there was massive youth unemployment, record unemployment in young people after the recession and the job centre there. Have you ever signed on, Alexei?
Yeah, a couple of times. I never, I was sort of weird. I didn't like it. I mean, it was a lot easier. I don't think most people do. No.
No one goes, oh, bloody loved it, that.
Well, people, I mean, I always felt I'd rather, and you had this the choice then, which, you know, you probably don't have now, but I mean, I would have been signing on and did sign on probably in the, so it'd be late 60s.
Mm.
Is that right? Yeah. 68, 69, something like that. And I'd rather have done a shit job than sign on. So it made me very uncomfortable, really.
Yeah.
Signing on. I mean, I knew other people who were perfectly happy with it, really. Then it was a, but no. So, well, and probably when I say I do shit jobs, I would probably just pounce off my parents. And pretend I was doing a shit. And I was, but the other thing, yeah, because if I was doing like shit jobs, I was always getting fired. That was really
Times did you get fired?
For a while I've never had a job that I wasn't fired from. there was that one where we did that bike ride, the last one we did.
Yeah, the
primary school. Yeah, caretaker. Where I was assistant caretaker at primary school. And I was always a terrible skiver. You know, I was always somebody who'd like, you know, really elaborate kind of scams to avoid doing work. And but the lollipop man saw me sneaking home and reported me to the caretaker. And then I did learn to drive just so I could run that lollipop man over. But I think he's probably gone by then.
You got him in the long run then, basically.
I think we know who's, you know.
Yeah.
I think we know who's came out on top. Unless that lollipop man is like Rupert Murdoch or something, or Jeff Bezos. Which I don't think he is.
I mean, what an origin story that would be for Rupert Murdoch.
a humble lollipop man in Fulham until he started publishing. I was fired from the Jubilee line from the, I don't know if I've talked about, I was when I if you go south from Green Park on the Jubilee line, I dug about the first 4 feet as you leave the station at Green Park, and then I got fired for just being so terrible. There was a few jobs. I was a dinner lady in a private school for a while.
Surely you were a dinner man.
Well, I don't. I like the idea of being. Yes. I don't know where it would. You know, I don't know where it, how you correctly describe it now. It's a minefield, isn't it, really, all that?
When you say dinner person.
Dinner person, yeah. But I just like the idea of being a dinner lady, really.
Were you in a dress when you did it?
Yeah, dress, you know. No, I wasn't. I was just in, you know, whatever I wore in those days. But it was a private school in Kensington. And
did you put on the really like, high-pitched voice? So you're like, oh, what do you want for dinner?
Now I was like, I think it was all little girls doing ballet, really. I think they were all probably terrified of me. I was like, they didn't eat much, really. So I'd say like one sprout or two. And then they used to do like these vegetable rissoles, and most of the kids didn't. I mean, I'd sneak them, a lot of them home.
Mm.
And me and Linda would sit up in bed eating these vegetable rissoles.
So you stole...
I stole the food out of the mouths of children, yes. I have literally done that, yeah. Yeah.
You're like the opposite of Marcus Rashford.
in a lot of different ways. Sadly, though, I mean, that's a sort of, I don't know whether that's a kind of the gods' evenings thing. I mean, interestingly, since we're going in that direction, I mean... Marcus Rashford's kind of elevation as a kind of hero of the working class has coincided with a disastrous loss of form, hasn't it, as a footballer? Mm. So it's like, I don't know what that's saying about the gods, really. if we're taking that particular route.
Yeah, he's got a Marxism-related injury, clearly.
Mm. Yeah, we insist on that. That could be a lesson that if you become too interested in the expropriation of wealth and the a kind of materialist analysis of history, then your form will suffer. I don't know. That's maybe a controversial thing, but he's obviously the team he's playing in also has its problems, doesn't it?
But of course, I don't know if you know this, but I believe I'm right in saying Michael Foot, when he was about 92, I think he was registered as a player for Plymouth Argyle. And that they put him on the team as like a birthday present.
Right.
So for him, it gave him some sort of super form that meant he's like the oldest professional footballer in history.
Yeah.
I mean, he wasn't actually, but they registered him on the team sheet. Like,
that's so cool. I'm guessing that was his team. He loved his team, it was just like...
Imagine if it wasn't his team.
Yeah.
Like, we need a new signing. All right, let's contact Michael.
He's got Foot in his name. He's got to be good.
Bobby Ball wasn't available, so...
Well, I didn't know that. Thank you for telling me that. Where are you from?
I'm from, Watford area.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
You've been a bit vague about that. It's not like Watford area.
Well,
Watford.
Yeah, Watford.
So you were signing on, and that was your first. Was that your first ever set? Was about the benefits?
No, I only started talking about it. About never having much money and being from very sort of working class / benefit class. Background and talking about the stigma faced by people on benefits, which of course has been a thing for fucking decades. Do you know what I mean? It's been a thing that comes from fucking, I mean, all of human history in Britain has kind of had that, you know, shitting on the poor thing.
Absolutely, and,
It did well in Edinburgh and people liked it. And then it eventually got commissioned for a Radio 4 series called Tom Mayhew's Benefit Scum. Which I basically called it that because I thought it'd be funny to hear posh Radio 4 people say that. And it was funny. It was very funny. They did say, when I called it that, the people at Radio 4, at first they went, yeah, we can't call it that. And I was like, oh, no, but I'm fine with it. I'm fine. I'm in on the joke. Right. And eventually they went, okay, we'll call it that.
Nice.
But I had to kind of fight for it. But, It was the first time I did a show that was very like pissed off at the establishment institutions like the DWP and the government and their treatment of poor people, which is it's continued. It's we had austerity. We've got the cost of living crisis, which my next show is going to be about. And I find it really weird when people from my generation aren't fucking furious all the time.
Right. I have found, certainly in the early parts of my career, that there's several times when catastrophic kind of failure impelled me towards success, really. Those have been the most important points in a way. And actually, one was my first night at the Edinburgh Fringe when I had a terrible, disastrous performance.
What happened?
I'd been MC at a comedy store, and then me and Tony Allen had gone up there, but I think I don't know what went wrong. I think the opening night, because I'd been MCing, that the everything was still in chunks, and I remember actually saying at one point, "This is treating it as if it was like a song or a recital," saying, "Oh, this bit is something," and then I went into like a bit. It just fucking died. It was terrible. And I felt we were going to alternate who opened and closed each night. And the people who were putting it on said, no. I think, Tony should probably close the show every night. I felt so humiliated.
I mean, you're probably fucking. This is the life. I don't know what I'm saying. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. This is the life we've chosen, you know. But yeah, it was terrible. But I stayed up all night, and we were staying in a caravan outside, and I was just really upset and like just angry at myself, really. And so the next night, I was so full of anger that I went back and I just completely exploded the show. So just naturally. Almost without conscious thought, really, because I was in such a state of fury with myself and with the audience. And that's really when my performance style finally coalesced, really. It was that night, that second night.
So what was your style like before that?
Well, it was a bit more... It was sort of like that, but a bit more... Love?
Oh, you look nice. Yeah, oh, yeah. Anybody,
where you two together.
You are. I love you. Where are you from? What do you do?
Yeah.
I can't picture you ever saying that shit.
No. It wasn't... It was like that, but it was sort of like it wasn't... I think because me... It was doing half an hour, really, each at Edinburgh, and I think... It was only in 5 minute or 10 minute bits, so it wasn't. So the difference that I made was that it became a kind of coherent whole. So routines would flow into each other. You know, there was this kind of extra insane kind of energy that maybe there was also the thing about the Comedy Store was that it was a wild venue, so you needed that kind of attack. Mm-hmm. I think I had a quieter audience at Edinburgh, and the first night I kind of fitted in with them, whereas I realised on the second night that I needed to bring that aggression, even if, does that make sense? If they weren't like a wild audience, I would treat them as if they were, kind of thing that I would attack them. Anyway, I think that was what I brought to the second night. And after that, there was no question about who was closing the show. Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's really interesting, because I'd say even nowadays it is like, you know, you have your club audience and then Edinburgh tends to be more like a theatre audience. So yeah. Even nowadays it is more like, unless it's a proper late night Edinburgh show, usually it's a bit more like a theatre audience, a bit more polite, a bit less rowdy.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. That was your experience, even when you
were... Yeah, they were, I think, but it really threw me, I think, that they weren't so rowdy. But as I say, what I took from that is that I had to bring, whether or not, it didn't matter, in a sense, what they were like. Mm. I had to be a certain way, you know, because that was part of the experience. But did you find those... So you had, like, 2 years in between. I mean, was the 2017 show, in the harsh way? I mean, did it deserve not to do well, or was it...
I thought it was fine as a show. Do you know what I mean? I think by the end of Edinburgh, it was a good show. I just don't think it was ready at the start.
Right.
And I kind of, I went up with the attitude of, I want to make this a really good show by the end of it. But I think to have any chance of success in Edinburgh, it needs to be...
I mean, in a way, that's what Edinburgh should be like, where you can do that. But the trouble is you can't anymore, can't you? It's this kind of pressure cooker of...
Yeah,
you can't fuck about anymore, really.
Which is a shame, really. I mean, I think you can fuck about if you're established, but when you're trying to make your name, obviously people want it to be fucking perfect, because otherwise why would they see you fuck about? But yeah, so I think it just taught me that I had to be more polished and precise. And then, you know, when I came back in 2019, it was a far more previewed and worked on, and, you know, I had my partner directing it and stuff, so it was far more just... better structured and just a much better show. Like, far, far better. Better venue, better everything. Like, you know, I feel like in 2017, I was doing it on my own, whereas I came out with a bit of a team. Like, I had, you know, a director, I had people helping with flyering and production kind of sides, and it just made it feel far less lonely.
Right.
Because I think, I don't know how you felt it when you've been touring and stuff. It's quite lonely, it can be.
Can be, yeah. I mean, I've always had Linda, so... Yeah, she's been the sort of the centre of it, really. So I've never really been on the road by myself.
Mm. Would you ever get Linda on one of these podcasts?
I've had email requests that she should be a guest one day and she should have her own podcast.
Will you go on her podcast?
You should be the first guest on
and
that.
And then Wilf will on his own podcast.
a whole spin-off universe of them. That'd be great.
Yeah, it's like the Marvel universe. Yeah. This would be the Alexi Sale universe.
Sale-iverse.
I don't know, she doesn't really care. She She pops up in the radio show from time to time. And I think she was in the Jeremy Corbyn one, wasn't she?
Yes.
She sort of pops up.
That's when people started saying you should give her her own show.
Yeah.
She should be a guest. I think maybe once you get more comfortable revealing more about yourself, personal self, like private self, if that ever comes. Not
there's
that
always
going
to be a limit to that.
But then that would be the kind of chat you and Linda would have, right? Talking about your flaws and your...
The floor, do you mean the flooring or?
Yes, very nice.
Getting you flooring.
Interior decor.
Imagine if you got her on, it was just a really tedious thing about your house and your windows.
Well, she was, I remember we were, when I, the BBC flew me out to the Golden Rose of Montreux festival to try.
What the fuck is that?
The Golden Rose. You don't know what the Golden... Oh, that was the biggest comedy prize in its day, the Golden Rose of Montreux.
Oh, Montreux.
Montreux. I say it with a...
Yes, you say it properly.
Provence accent.
Wait,
yeah.
So what was this?
Oh, it was... it's an international television festival.
No, but they flew you out?
Yeah, because I was up... I was going to win the gold. I've done a bit about this in the new series of Sandwich Bar, really, but then that won't go out until the end of the year. I was actually... So the Golden Rose of Montreux was like... It's obviously not as important to comedians as it used to be. It was a kind of international comedy festival held in Switzerland in the town of Montreux. And you won, like, a Golden Rose if you... And I won the Bronze Rose for... It was for... I think it was the all-new Alexis Hale show. If you won the Bronze Rose, then you could go through to win the silver. I think if you won the silver, then you can win the gold, something like that. So the BBC flew me out so that I could schmooze people, and which had the opposite effect, really, to try and get them to vote for make me a Golden Rose. Mm. But we were at dinner one night with the panel, the selection panel, and there was this guy, this Irish guy, who was an undercover priest. He was a plainclothes priest. He worked for... No, worse than that. But he worked for Vatican TV. That's how he was on the panel. But he was playing, and he said, I'm going to make sure that you never win the Golden Rose.
Wow.
And I said, why? Why? And he said, because of those things you said about the Pope. Mm-hmm. And I said, I don't remember. And then it sort of came back to me that I'd been playing the Olympia Theatre in Dublin in the 80s, and I said something about the Pope, and the audience were so scandalized and thrilled that I got a bit carried away. And I remember I was banned from the Olympia Theatre in Dublin, but also it must have made, you know. Anyway, so this undercover priest said, you're never going, and I didn't. He stopped me from getting the Golden Rose.
I mean, if anyone should forgive you, it should probably be the Pope. Like.
Yeah. Different Pope, you know, different time.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
That was Jean-Paul back then, wasn't it?
It was Wojtyła, the Polish one, I think. Why was I talking about that?
I don't know. We started on benefits and now...
Talking about TV festivals in Switzerland. I don't know.
Well, you were talking about Edinburgh and touring.
Oh, right, yeah.
And getting Linda on the
phone. Oh, Linda flew with you.
Anyway, she got very friendly with these two gay guys who produced a show for Canadian TV, and they were going to give Linda her own show. And what it was going to be about was stain removal. Because I'm a very sloppy eater, so Linda is brilliant at stain removal. And so it was going to be on Canadian television. It was going to be called Ask Linda, eh?
Ask Linda, eh?
Ask Linda, eh? Open a boat with Linda. They said, then we got really excited about this. So Linda was going to have her own show. Yeah, so it was going to be called Ask Linda, eh? And it was going to be about stain removal, because they said, how'd you get gum out of chewing gum out of her? And she immediately said, ice cube, you know, freeze it. And then the gum will harden and you can brush it out.
I really hope that that you go before her, because I don't want her gravestone to go, oh, Alexi, what should we put? And she goes, oh, Linda, she was really good at stain removal.
That'd be a epitaph. Well, you know, it's a skill. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know whether she likes shouting from the sidelines.
Yeah.
There's one, actually, I don't know if it's the one episode.
One of the live episodes she gets involved in.
Yeah. And there's the one of the, it's Sandwich Bowl when we have a row about, because she says, she always told me she could instantly convert decimal currency into the old money.
That's Sandwich Bar.
A Sandwich Bar, yeah.
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 Which has nothing to do with this production.
No. Anyway, well, I can't remember. Yeah. So the old Linda's always been there. So I've not, that's right. It's about loneliness on not having a team.
But yeah, I think it'd be good for you to have her on because, I mean, she was there before you were even comedy addict.
Yeah.
She knew you before you ever did comedy. And I think that's a very interesting perspective to talk to her about what it was like on the sidelines, because you only know your experience of living it, whereas her watching you, you know, rise up from a guy who had never been on stage to in bloody films, do you know what I mean? That's an incredible perspective. Yeah. And you've been together all through it.
Yeah. I don't know if she'd talk seriously about it. I don't know. She has a,
It would be interesting to see what comes up, comes out of it.
Obviously it's up to her. I'm not going to force her. Just recording it in the bedroom. Just be like, come on, Linda. I've just left it on, so don't do that. Look.
Anyway, so back to you, Tom. So did you go to college or any of that shit?
I dropped out of university.
What were you studying? Where did you go?
I was studying creative writing at the 120th best university in the country.
Nice. Which was where?
In Luton.
Luton University.
That's another way of saying it used to be Luton College, and then they changed it to university so they'd make more money.
Yeah. Oh.
So it wasn't even the proper university.
I mean, did you go there because you wanted to be a kind of an artist? I mean, you're what did that? So you were watching like Blackadder and the Young Ones on telly, and you thought you didn't watch it as a passive kind of absorber, as it were. You thought, I want to do that.
I properly got obsessed with it. I would sort of read so many interviews and then listen to so many podcasts. Like, we're kind of blessed as a generation, really, that growing up we had like all this stuff at our fingertips on the internet, all these right. interviews, all these articles.
You think that's a good thing, do you?
Well, in terms of research and learning and learning about the craft and the industry, it kind of is a great resource that we would never have had, 4 years ago or whatever.
And I suppose
and we had the internet before it went shit, before it went, south.
Yeah. But my history is is that I was pretty uninterested in comedy in a sense, but also I didn't buy. I mean, the only way that you could do it my day would be to buy comedy records, and I didn't really do any of that. So my whole understanding of comedy, stand up comedy, was based on Richard Pryor, the Lenny Bruce film about Lenny Bruce, but played by Dustin Hoffman.
Oh, yeah.
And, some books I'd read, really. So, I was completely uninformed, really. Mm. Which which was good for me. But then I was inventing comedy, as we've agreed. So I think, and now comedy is, I don't know, where do you think, what's the business like now? What's it like being you in this world kind of thing? And also, I suppose, one of the things you like about me is that I have stayed consistently left wing, or at least people have conveniently forgotten the times when I fucked up.
You've never gone full right wing. Do you know what I mean? Like, you've always been like, consistently. People are like, cool, I know generally what ballpark he's in.
I've never done stuff like Comic Relief, for instance. And obviously, the people who founded Comic Relief. I mean, in a sense, I don't know how you feel about stuff like that, but I always was very distrustful of Comic Relief. And I knew like Lisa and a lot of the people who founded it, but I think they asked me to do it in the early days, and I always refused.
Did you regret not doing the Young One single?
No, not at all. I um, No, because it would have been on Comic Relief, and I hated Comic Relief, so no, I wasn't bothered.
You could have had a number one.
Yeah, but no, I would have. It would have made me feel bad.
What is it? Is it are you suspicious about? It's a bit patronising, Comic Relief, or what?
It's the nature of. I think the nature of that kind of charity is. There are questions that are never asked about, you know, whether it's a sticking plaster, really, whether if you put it, you know, it just allows injustice to continue, really, by ameliorating the worst effects, you know, and that's a point of view. But also the thing I thought about, I mean, I think probably the thing that I was that bad work, bad self-indulgent work was excused because it was being done in the name of you know, charity, really. And I know, and also, you know, that I know somebody who went out on one of those, you know, and they were, one of those went to, you know, some refugee camp, and the crew were saying, oh, you know, do something funny with that goat kind of thing. You know, there was a kind of a house style, really, that of kind of patronising, and they refused. But, I mean...
When I've got an image of them saying that to someone and them just fucking the goat, and yeah, we can't use that.
Yeah,
what were you expecting?
but no, there was what I really hated about it, I think, was it was hierarchical as well. That it was that if you got, and you can see all those careers that have been made, and I think that there's philosophically, I like a lot of the philosophy of Immanuel Kant, the moral philosopher. And, you know, Kant said that the only moral act is one done out of duty, really, which was what he meant was that the only moral act that you could do was when you got nothing out of it personally. And I think clearly the people who are doing Comic Relief and people who are doing Live Aid, because people talk about Live Aid, what they talk about is how fucking it restored Queen to the firmament. You know, that's the main takeaway from that. Whereas Queen had played apartheid South Africa.
And it made Bob fucking Geldof a household
and
name.
And Geldof as well, yes. Yeah, exactly. And I think that that's morally, profoundly morally wrong, really. And Comic Relief would make people's careers. And I think that, that there's a real moral black hole about doing that. You know, but people involved with it would say, well, you know, we built these schools, we've, you know, all of which is true. You know, that's I think it very strongly comes down on the debit side, really. So that's what.
And there's something dubious about millionaires going on television to ask lower class people to call in and give a £30 donation.
Yeah, all that. Yeah.
Well, also, I find it weird when some people like they'll see Comic Relief, they'll see there's a Comic Relief single. They'll buy it for £2 and go, right, that's my work done.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you're like, no, man, there's all sorts of shit going on.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, and it also implies that there's some kind of, there's a simple solution to the problems of the world, the problems of poverty and injustice and inequality, and there isn't. Well, there is a simple solution, possibly, which is the abolition of the forcible removal of capitalism.
Yeah, when are we going to do that?
I don't know, we had a go. What do you think? I think it'd be a good idea. Well, you know, of course, the other thing is when people have tried to do that, it's gone a bit wrong. So we have to take that into account as well. But, yeah, anyway, sorry, I forgot again. Where are we?
How do you get into comedy, Tom?
I'm liking this very rambling.
When did you start? Yeah, this is great. What was your leap into it? What was your first set like?
My first set was about being a very sad, lonely person and being very depressed because I was a very... the first time I did stand-up was when I was signing on and my whole set was about being really depressed and feeling like a failure. And eventually I had that moment in my mid-20s when I was like, no, you're not a failure. It's just a shitty system you're in and you've been let down by a system where, you know, the number of unemployed people was far higher than the number of vacancies, which meant there was tons of people unemployed. And then... that's when I kind of had the real moment where it clicked and I came back with a show that was more like, you know, loads of people are put in this horrible situation where they're struggling to find a job. And then they're just faced with this stigma or this shit treatment by the job centre and these sanctions for no reason and this judgment from society when really it's just lots of people mainly working hard who want to get a job, who don't want to be in that situation. Most people don't want to fucking live off 50 quid a week because you can barely live off 50 quid a week. So that was kind of the fuel for my show. And I was thinking about it literally a few days ago because it's really, I think, part of the reason for me doing a show that was me going, I'm on benefits, and if you've got a problem, fuck you, I don't care. Don't judge me based on that. Judge me as a human. That was basically the message of the show. And I think part of the reason for doing that was because I grew up with stuff like Little Britain and Catherine Tate, where a lot of the comedy was very punchy down, and it was, here's a character that's a chap who's stupid or a single mum who's an idiot. Do you know what I mean? It was all a lot of that stuff where it was just posh men and posh women going, let's take the piss out of these people. And I don't know, what did you make of that kind of comedy? Because that was obviously sort of the era after you, I suppose.
Well, no, several eras after me, I think, really. I didn't... I mean, I'd like to say that I, you know, condemned it, but I didn't sort of mind it. I mean, I thought it's funny, isn't it, really? I mean, well, David, well, I know all of those people like a little bit, really. So that complicates things, I suppose. David Walliams has actually complained about me in his memoirs, which is the two people have slagged me off in their memoirs, Stephen Fry and David Walliams.
What did they say?
David Walliams, when I did my last series of stand-up, Alexis Hale's Merry-Go-Round in 1997, he had a very small part in it, and he says I wasn't nice to him, and which I probably wasn't. But then he's resolved to be, and he said that impelled him to always be nice to people, which I'm not sure if that's the case. Maybe it is. But he said, I was a series that I wasn't happy with. You know, I had a lot of worries on that series. So, you know, I probably wasn't nice to him really. But that's irrelevant really.
I mean, people would argue that he wasn't nice to a whole race of people by doing blackface.
I was going to say, all transvestites. I'm a lady characters.
At the time, though, you did sort of think, I mean, particularly later when they did that thing sat in an airline, didn't he? You thought, oh, fucking hell, that's getting really quite dodgy.
The other thing for me is I was young when those shows came out, and I found them really funny.
Yeah.
And then, but I didn't know anything about what class they're in, who they represented. I just saw these funny characters on screen.
Yeah, I think...
And I was laughing my ass off, and then you grow up and think about it.
And I would say at the time, I would like to pretend that I didn't mind those shows. Really.
Well, things moved on a lot, I suppose.
Yeah, that's also true, yeah.
But I think they've obviously, they were fine at the time, otherwise they wouldn't be so popular, but I think they've dated very quickly because how society's moved on in terms of, you know, things with race, things with sexuality, things with gender. All this stuff's moved on so quickly.
Yeah.
I think
certainly somebody like Catherine Tate seems to be somebody who's very much spinning their wheels by not being able to move on from that, certainly, comedically.
Mm.
Well, a lot's changed since David Walliams invented sketch comedy.
He didn't! I did!
Oh, yeah!
I didn't invent sketch comedy. I can't claim that.
Maybe the problem is that like alternative comedy was a reaction to the sort of racism and sexism and misogyny and all of that stuff. And then I feel like a lot of those, that era of sketch shows had a lot of, and things like, you know, Family Guy had a lot of, like, ironic racism and ironic sexism that actually has dated quite badly because it was like ironic, but really you're just doing blackface or whatever it is like. So
It is weird, isn't it? Because you started doing it ironically and then suddenly that gives you free rein to go for it, and then you're just pushing the limit as far and far as far as you can go.
Yeah.
But I will also say that your response, it seems to me that your response is correct in rather than just moaning about it, that it impelled you to do to make your art about something that wasn't that.
Yeah. Well, I know you've spoken before on the podcast about how, like, can or should comedians, you know, be like political spokespeople or be involved with this stuff. And I generally feel like, you know, I don't think her comedy show is going to lead to us having the left-wing leader. But I do think the one thing I think comedy can do is be solidarity for people in that situation.
Right.
You know, so I don't think me doing the show about being on benefits is going to make the DWP not be arseholes, no. frankly. But I think it will mean if there's people in the audience who had people, you know, who've, whether their dads were treated by, whether their parents were treated as shit by the DWP or they've had an awful experience seeing it, it gives you that comfort and you feel less alone and you feel.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that is the job, yeah, is to do that really, not to try and change things.
Like how a sad song can make you happy. If I'm feeling sad and I listen to a sad song,
you learning about someone else's trauma that's similar to your own, it means it resonates with you and makes you feel a bit better sometimes.
Yeah, but I mean that whole kind of conversation. It's also that it's kind of a conversation I'm having with myself in a way in the podcast about, you know, whether you know to you know where activism without humour fits into the you know.
Would you ever run as an MP?
No, I don't think so. I think that, for who, apart from anybody else? I mean, certainly I hate the Labour Party. And then if I ran for one of them factional little kind of, so you know, left-wing parties, that would just be humiliating, really. And I also, I don't think that's the job. I mean, you clearly have you do see performers who've, you know, crossed over. I mean, obviously, I don't know whether Zelensky's making us all look bad or all look good, really. It's hard to know, isn't it, really? I don't know quite if he was a stand-up or a comic actor, didn't he?
He was both.
Yeah, was he? Yeah, so he was a stand-up.
Yeah, I think in Ukraine. Yeah. He didn't do a fringe show.
Yeah, he was never at the Edinburgh Festival. No.
He will be now.
When he retires. Well,
he certainly, you know.
Imagine if he does an hour at Edinburgh about the war right now.
Yeah.
About being president and shit.
Oh, yeah, it'd be an interesting show, wouldn't it, really? Wow. If he could be honest about it, yeah.
And what's Izzard doing at the moment? Is he a politician yet? Because I know he kept putting his foot in and out.
Yeah.
Is he doing that yet?
I think Izzard use she pronouns now.
Yes.
Please excuse me.
Oh, my God!
No, I grew up with
them. No, I know, him, it's fucking, it's confusing when things like that change, you know what I mean?
But, when it's someone you've known your whole life.
We can edit that bit out so you don't sound like a pig.
It's quite right. People are human and make mistakes.
That's very true.
So, yeah. Do you currently know her political involvement? Because she was a Labour politician or councillor?
I think
councillor?
On the right of the Labour Party.
Though. Yeah, very Blairite-y, I think.
Yeah.
New Labour-y.
You know, yeah, so...
But anyway.
That's not...
I don't think you should run to be an actual MP, but I think you should... You know when they have those silly little people who run against politicians?
Yeah.
I think we should get you to run against Keir Starmer for the next election.
Right.
I like the idea of him sat there looking really boring with no personality and you there with like a massive grin on your face with a T-shirt that just has something like Sir Cunt Starmer or something on it. Something ridiculous.
Suck Keir Starmer.
Well, because there was, I don't know, did we posit that thing? I mean, there was ideas, wasn't there? Obviously, in a sense, the Corbyn project was in a way for, you know, there was a certain amount of entryism in the people. I mean, the people, left-wing people, joined the Labour Party because they were inspired by Jeremy. And then there was a similar idea that we could maybe, that Corbyn members on bloc could join the Green Party and then make it more radical. But perhaps our entryism could instead be directed at the Monster Raving Loony Party. If all those people who've been expelled from the Labour Party or disillusioned by Labour would join the
Monster
Raven Loomer Party.
500,000 people.
Yeah, 500,000 people. Socialists, Marxists,
just
syndicalists.
As a massive middle finger up to the status quo.
Well, we took it over. You've already got name recognition, you know, which is one of the problems that, you know, like the Trade Union and Socialist Party, don't have name recognition. So if we could join... Yeah, I mean, it's a sense of what you're suggesting, that if the whole Corbyn bloc, disillusioned socialists, if we take over the Monster Raven Loony Party, then and rebuild it into a viable socialist alternative. then.
No, because that absolutely. There needs to be a new party. Yeah, there needs to be a new alternative. And, yeah. But starting from nothing is really fucking
really
hard.
Impossible in art. So you need that name recognition. A little jump start. Yeah. I think we should do that.
Can we recruit the Binhead guy into it?
Absolutely.
He's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. What we'd have to obviously ask him, you know, where he stands on questions of, you know.
Imagine getting him on this podcast and you having a really frank discussion about how do you stand on
and social democracy versus, dictatorship of the proletariat.
Piece of genius, really? If I remember correctly.
So yeah, maybe I'll need a party to, you know, maybe I'll lead that entryism, that, you know, as militant.
And can you do it as the tight suit Alexis Sale?
Do you think I'll give myself maybe Bobby Chariot could.
Maybe we should get him on this show.
Right.
Get him as a guest. Sorry, go on.
You should be, it should just be Keir Starmer and then you in six different characters.
Yeah.
Every time the camera moves, you step along to the next.
Yeah. You quickly change your costume.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's
I would love to see you just job up against Keir. Because this is his constituency too.
Yeah,
perfect. There we go.
Yeah. I'm a local. What about my bins, Keir? They're really well collected. You get like three collections.
That's
a week.
The
it's
council,
amazing.
It's not him.
So where are you now? What's your day? You know, what's your life like now? As a, you've had Radio 4. You've had a couple of. You got an upcoming Radio 4 series.
Yeah, I got.
Was it Sean Edu commissioned there?
It was. Yeah.
She's lovely, and she's great.
She's great. Yeah. I'm very thankful to her.
Yeah,
she basically took a punt on me when. I hadn't done anything, you know. Yeah. I've done the live show, but it's a different thing doing the radio show. So yeah. I'll always be thankful, really.
Did it make a difference doing the radio show? Did you were you able to move up a venue size or two?
I'm not too sure, you know, because the annoying thing with my show is that the first series was both recorded and went out during lockdown.
Right.
I couldn't actually see any immediate, you know. Rise up because we weren't gigging, like literally it was recorded over Zoom. It was a bit of a weird experience. But I'm hopeful for Edinburgh there will be people will be more aware of me, more interested in my work, and the audience numbers will be better. That'd be nice. But you never know. It's such a weird time. I don't know how much gigging you're doing at the moment.
No.
Not at all.
Apart from working with Talal, the odd work in progress show for Sandwich Bar and the live podcast, I haven't done anything else. And I don't really know. I'm 70 this year, so that's...
Can you say that again, but say it in the voice?
I'm out of voice. I'm 70 this year. I was resisting the temptation to do it in that voice.
He was having a sincere moment there.
Yeah. I'm 70. I'm still very sprightly, though. I remain optimistic. I'm 70. Yes, I'm 70 this year. I'm 70 this year. I'm glad you noticed I'm doing that voice. Is that a thing, that voice? Yeah.
No, I think it's beautiful.
Yeah.
I'm hoping on your birthday, Linda will go, you're 70.
In this series of Sandwich, but I mean, my working method, and we could talk about this a little bit, has always been to not do. I mean, I don't know whether it was Stuart's fault, really, but that idea of, like, doing a new show every couple of years is a newish idea, I think. My working method was always to have a show which constantly changes. And so, you keep doing the bits until the bits that work until they stop working, and then you replace it with something else. So my show has gradually mutated, so there was no point where show one became show two. And similarly with my stand-up, really, there was no point where the show that when I came back in whenever it was 2012 or something, there was no point when that 2012 show became the 2019 show, 2020 show. Mm. But nevertheless, they it mutated. Really. But now I have the new series of Sandwich Bar, which is supposed to be transmitted in December this year. I've blown everything. There's nothing left. It's absolutely, I mean, I'm so strapped for material that, like, there's I've got nothing now. I've got, I would have to start with a blank.
Is that exciting?
No, it's no.
It would just be an hour of I'm 17.
I'm 17 now.
I'm not very well.
Yeah, I've got nothing.
I'm too old to run a sandwich bar.
Yeah. I'm too old to be doing this. So I'm faced with a dilemma, really. I've got no starting point.
Mm.
You know, like growing, I would say kefir or something, where you've got like a mould, you know, that you start from. I haven't got that. That mold. I've got no starting point, really.
I think that's proper exciting, though.
You think I should book some gigs?
I think you should book some gigs in, and you can literally can be whatever you want.
I can literally fail. Attention, 17.
Well, you wouldn't fail. It would just be a different type of success.
Yeah. Maybe I don't know whether I have the energy anymore. I mean, but yeah, we'll see. Really. Yeah. I don't know what it'd be about. I mean, certainly the live, you know, the podcasty stuff that we do is, it's an easier way to do it, really.
Mm. But, do you think you might do more live podcasts?
Yeah, I think so. I like keeping them. We did have somebody wanted to take it big, really, and I actually didn't. I quite like it very small, though, keeping it small.
It's not big. It's not big.
Bigger.
We're going to do the cartoon museum soon.
Yeah. Yeah.
How big's the cartoon museum?
It's not big. It's like 100 people, maybe less.
Well, the people that are like only a foot high.
The little cartoons. They're on the
Goofy's
walls.
Goofy's going to be there. The Minions are going to be there.
Have you ever seen the end of Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Yeah. We're doing it in Toontown.
Yeah.
I would love to see that.
Oh, come along.
Yeah, come along to that one.
Who's the one cartoon character you would want there and the one cartoon character you wouldn't want there?
Oh, right. Nice. I don't know. I'm not that... well, I'm a...
Who would I want there?
Well, Brian and Stewie from Family Guy. Mm. I'd want them there, really.
Yeah.
I think...
send out an invite.
Yeah, you know, I know Brian a little bit. Stewie, I haven't met. Brian, I know. I'd like them to be there, really.
And we're not gonna have the Tasmanian Devil back because he wrecked the place, and it wasn't.
Well, and Scrooge McDuck, he's a bit Tory, isn't he? So
Is he? I don't know. You're more up on this.
He always dives into coins at the start of
really.
Of his,
Do you know anybody know SpongeBob SquarePants? Is he nice?
Maybe he's a laugh. He's a great guy.
Yeah, maybe he could.
No, the cartoon museum is about like comic strips and newspaper comics and stuff, and they reached out to us because. They said Alexi's got an interesting relationship with cartoons, and he illustrated your
bus journeys
book.
Yeah.
And so they wanted, and they've been putting on shows as an experimental thing recently.
But that's kind of where I like to do, rather than making a kind of professional thing out of it. I like doing the live podcast. It's very, very enjoyable. We did a couple at the Museum of Comedy. I like doing them in. Kind of shonky venues, you know, like the cartoon museum. I'm very excited about it. We need to tie down a date to do that, don't worry.
I've got some dates for you. We'll talk
okay,
later.
Okay, cool.
Are you going to do one in the Monkey World?
I don't know. we've got, you know, obviously Tank Museum where they're very keen to have us doing. To do
I think
my,
we're just waiting for the world to get a bit less war-y.
It's just a bit. It's a bit. Yeah, it's a bit problematic at the moment. Talking about your. I'm doing this show for Radio 4 called Strangers on a Train. I had a very interesting conversation with a young woman about her favourite tank. She worked in the defence industry, and she said, "We had a mate. I mean, actually, we haven't used it in the show actually, but." She said her favourite tank was the T-72, and I said, "Obviously, well, it's been shown to be vulnerable." In current war, and she said, "Yeah, because it was designed before It's because of a conversation I'm having with a young woman on a train. She said, well, it was designed before N-Laws, and I don't know if you know much about munitions, but N-Laws or javelin, you know.
Absolutely. And I said, I don't know any of this.
And I said, yeah. And she said, but aesthetically, you know, I love the T-72. So I asked her to marry me.
When a comedian talks about in-laws, it's normally another type of in-laws.
No, this is a British/Swedish anti-tank rocket call. It's letters, N.
Oh, no, I gathered. L-A, yes, yeah, yes, I gathered.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what it means. But
I mean, we should say for the listeners, we are here in your conservatory, and there is the Art of War books literally on the table.
Yeah, there by Sun Tzu, yeah.
What else is on this?
There's War Games. That's a book about, actually, funnily enough, Why Charity is Wrong.
Oh.
Yeah, nice. Written by a mad Dutch woman. Below that is an old copy of Autocar. I think Lenny Henry bought me as a present.
From 1979?
Yeah.
When did he buy it? Was it in 1979?
No, he bought it me a few years ago, I think. He probably told his assistant to. He probably subscribes to a present buying service.
Interesting. There's a book here by you or about you. Is it written by Mr. Roberts or it's by Alexis?
That's one of my not well selling novels.
I've not read that one.
Yeah. It's interesting. It was towards, I was sort of falling out of love with writing fiction in a way. You can have that. I'll sign it to you. You can have that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, why not?
I've not read that one.
Here, though, this is interesting because Labour's political... Isn't that... I mean, this is like I've put it out. Labour's political thought. Then there's all the collected poems of Raymond Carver. Then there's the political thought of Abdullah Öcalan, the great Kurdish thinker. And then there's Evelyn Waugh's Sword of Honour trilogy. An interesting guy. Wouldn't you like to meet... I'd love to meet that Alexei Sayle. He's going by the books, you know, yeah, he has like on his table.
I mean, you literally couldn't be better paced that underneath your sofa is a book called Things I Didn't Throw Out.
Is it?
Literally tossed underneath the sofa, hidden.
No, I don't know what... I don't know what that is. I don't know where that is. I don't think that's mine. Linda buys a lot of books. By Marcin Witcher. So I'm corrected. Somebody must have sent it to me, I think. Okay. So where are you, like, on your... what's your working life like at the moment, then, really?
I mean, it's tricky for comics at the moment, particularly ones of my level, because, you know, the cost of travel has gone up, but the cost of... Well, the payment for gigs hasn't, because... I think it's just a fucking tough time for the industry. You know, I think audience numbers are tricky because the cost of living crisis, people can't afford to go out, which means obviously promoters can't pay comedians anymore, but comedians pay more to get to the gigs. So it's just, it's almost like this government doesn't care about the arts. Can you believe that?
You shock me. You shock me, sir. Shock and abhor me.
Your music career.
Oh, right, okay.
Because I really love the Silly Noises song from The Young Ones, because it basically reminds me of my dad. Because he just walks around the house going like, eh, blah, 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 like, that's what he does.
Yeah.
And it was like, if my dad did comedy, he would be this song. And I didn't know if both that song and Dr. Martin's Boots, did you ever release them?
I don't know, to be honest. I'm not sure if I did, really. I don't know.
I find that a shocking injustice to the comedy.
Well, I was always a bit... I had ambiguous feelings about the music that I did, that I liked doing it, but I was never quite sure whether it was... I don't know. I sometimes sort of felt bad about it, really.
Because you're not Ed Sheeran or something?
I think a bit, yeah. I think, it was before...
I mean, I'd rather listen to your music than Ed Sheeran, I'll say that.
Well, thank you. Thank you. That's very kind. I think I don't know what... I mean, I had a lot of mad... I mean, I was... You know, what propelled me was obviously... You know, there was like 75% I made the right decisions, but then 25% I made fucking stupid decisions. I had a lot of mad kind of thoughts, really. So I think I always had ambiguous feelings about the music that I did. And so I didn't always... you know, I was always... I also think that... I'll tell you what the thing was. I think that then I felt, and I think it was true, that there wasn't... The comedians doing music then wasn't considered legitimate, really, in a way that there wasn't that crossover. It was... There was a way in which I saw myself, and I think I was seen as still a light entertainment kind of, you know, entertainer. And I think if you branched out into music... And what I was trying to do at my best was kind of make a... Because I was obviously interested in early hip-hop and stuff like that, and you can see that, that I was trying to make a kind of... a jump into that, really. But I think it was kind of sneered at by me trying to do that, that I was, because I was a light entertainment star, that I shouldn't get into music, really. That, that when comedians did music, then it was considered in a way illegitimate and sort of not really proper music. And I think I allowed that to influence me. Does that sort of sound about right?
Did you ever do proper music? Like,
I did. Well, I didn't. It was complicated.
It was conceptual, and like the lyrics were sometimes really interesting. But did you get it?
No, I missed it.
Fuck, there's a fly buzzing around.
I wouldn't usually want to kill a fly, but if I can squish it on The Art of War, there's something poetic about it.
Yeah.
Oh, she'd land on it again.
I might just open the door slightly and see if it will fly out. Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't, but like, what, if you had been allowed to or asked to, would you have tried to do proper
Well, I songs did, really. And... Yeah, I did, you know, but I didn't, it was, I don't know, I felt...
stop.
That was never going to work.
You're not an N-law, let it...
Just flow in Alexi. Yeah. I've just had a real, like, out-of-body experience where I'm like, I'm just throwing Alexi Selva's book in his own house at a fly.
Yeah. I did, well, I did Hello, John, Got New Motor, which was a big hit, eventually. Yes. And that was, obviously, that was produced by Alan Winstanley and...
well, see, I genuinely think if you did, like, a big Alexi Sale Greatest Hits album with all of the songs on it, like Dr. Martin Boots, like Silly Noises, like Hello, John, Got New Motor and all the other stuff, I think it, A... I think you'd sell a decent chunk of CDs because they've not been released in a CD or digital format.
Mm.
And B, I reckon there's a genuine chance of one of them going big on TikTok.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I think people would love that. And I reckon either it would go on TikTok and go viral, or we could do a campaign to get you Christmas number one.
Yeah.
Because they're not even... Your stuff isn't even on like Spotify or anything.
I think that's part of the fascinating thing about this podcast, because it's like... You hadn't done anything digital before this. You know, you had songs that were only on records. It's not even CDs.
Yeah, not even CDs. No, I predate CDs, really, yeah.
Have you never thought about, bringing it into an accessible medium nowadays?
I don't really care. if somebody could tell Al, can you do all that, what he said? Can you make it happen?
I guess I could.
Then you can take money out the Patreon account.
Money? Guys, sign up to our Patreon, please, and help us make this happen. Go to patreon.com/AlexiSaleBocca.
Well, who's got the rights to that music?
Sting, I think.
Michael Jackson.
It wasn't the Beatles stuff. It was all your back catalogue. That's what he spent all his
money on. If you could buy the rights to all your music, if you don't already have it, then we can make. Then we can do something with it.
Who owns the recordings is a complicated mess, really. I think probably a lot of them I actually do, but obviously I own the publishing, so the easiest thing would actually be to re-record them. But it's complicated.
Now that
really
is something I want to see. And we get Tarbush Records to like remake all the beats.
Yeah,
update them, make them more modern sounding. Yeah.
But you feel like making it more modern, is that a mistake, or should you do it as it was originally?
Not changing it, just making it sound better.
Yeah.
Well, I think some people might want both versions. A bit like Taylor Swift re-recorded their albums for different reasons recently.
Mm.
And I think it's one of those things where some people would love the newer ones, but other people would want the originals. But,
yeah.
I mean, either way, I think people would just be really happy to have Dr. Martin's Boots on a Spotify playlist.
Yeah, like, I agree.
Okay. I need it's because I don't really care about any of this. I need somebody dynamic to make it happen, really, and do it for me.
Well, maybe if part of this chat goes in, there'll be some hot shot record producer.
That's true. Yeah.
Who will relaunch your music career?
That would be true. Yeah.
What I also want to talk to you about is rap music.
Yeah.
Because you're obviously a bit of a hip hop fan, because you have Tarboosh Records and it's quite hip hop-y.
Yeah.
And I think
that's because he's his brother, but yeah.
are you a fan of hip hop apart from that?
Yeah. I not in any kind of coherent way, but I remember hearing, like, whenever it first came out, I remember hearing Rapper's Delight on the, by the Sugar Hill Gang, which is considered, I think, the first hip hop record, really, rap record. I remember hearing it on Radio 1 and thinking, wow, that's, something. And really, really liking it. And then obviously Grandmaster Flash, all that stuff, really early kind of New York hip hop. Yeah, I really liked that. But again, not in any coherent way. I don't know if I've told this story before. I saw the Beastie Boys and Run DMC getting out of a limousine in Tottenham Court Road and going into a money change shop. And so I went in after them because I knew that the Beastie Boys were fans of the Young Ones and spoke to one of them and said, "Oh, hi, I'm Alexi." And then invited me to their show that night at Brixton Academy. And I went along. And I remember having an awkward conversation with Ron and Run DMC over the buffet in the backstage area. Just as a sidebar.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's fucking rad, man.
Yeah. I never carried on the relationship, really. But
maybe they'll get in touch after this.
Yeah, podcast. Maybe they'll. Yeah, maybe, maybe.
But what I find really cool about rap music is that I know you've kind of bemoaned the lack of support of Jeremy Corbyn by comedians over, the five or six years that he was a mainstay in politics. But, rappers, in terms of the whole grind for Corbyn thing, in terms of Stormzy saying fuck the government, fuck Boris, in terms of, Dave released a song last year that name checks Jeremy Corbyn. And I think there's a lot of really, really good left wing rap, socially.
And low key, stuff. I suppose, as well.
Yeah, low key.
Yeah.
I mean, there's tons of it, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think it's that's my inspiration for comedy. Like, as much as, any comedian's shows would be, I think rap music and the way they express themselves and their opinions and their, this is what I believe, and if you don't like it, fuck you. I think that's proper, it's kind of like punk.
Yeah, I was about to say.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, I mean, certainly comedians were pusillanimous shitbags, weren't they, over that period, really? I mean, there was a few who's the guy out of Catastrophe? He was very pro Corbyn, the Canadian guy, Rob Delaney. He doesn't really do much stand up, I don't think.
Yeah, he was on. Yeah,
he was pro. I don't know whether he did pro Corbyn stand up, but he certainly. And apparently, he's still in Jeremy's Truth and Justice Superheroes Party or something. I don't know.
Oh, Peace and Justice Project.
Yeah.
is it a superhero party?
It sounds like it, doesn't it, really? Yeah. It's a Truth and Justice Commission. Truth and Justice League.
Yeah.
Jeremy, boom.
John Delaney.
Oh, I'm a single mother living in a rat-infested apartment. Oh, if only somebody could tell me. It's the Truth and Justice Commission.
They knock down the wall, going through the wall into a flat.
It's Jeremy.
Who's going to pay for that? He goes,
some people from Momentum.
We're just here to fix the leak, he said.
it's funny. I mean, I don't know. Why do you think the comedians were so weak, really, about it?
I definitely feel like there's, especially in terms of, you know, comedians who are on telly, I think a lot of them are apolitical, really.
Yeah.
Like you think of, like, even the early days of Mock the Week in 2005, they'd have, like, a Jeremy Hardy and a Mark Steele or a Mark Thomas or people like that, whereas now they just get someone who's not even a political comedian. They put them on there.
Right.
And it's like, yeah, that person doesn't even talk about politics in their set, but
yeah,
you pay them to do Mock the Week, and them and their writer write some topical material.
Right.
But it's like, they don't really care, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's especially left-wing comedians, I feel like I think they're scared of booking them because they know there might be an outrage.
Right.
I think, you know, why are you not on these shows? Why are you not on Live at Apollo or Mock the Week? Would you do them, or would they even offer you it
though? No, I don't. I mean, they wouldn't offer it me, I don't think. But also, I can't be bothered. I mean, it's funny, really, because, I mean, in a way, I mean, it's something I was thinking a bit. If I was, like, in my 40s, I mean, it'd be an interesting time for me to be in my 40s. And I think it would, give me a, you know, I think I would have done something different, really. But, like, you know, you've got a kind of different attitude to things, really. You haven't got that drive to. But in a way, I sort of regret that, in a way, that I'm not. I think it would be an interesting time for me to be a younger comic now, you know? You know, because it's so fertile in a way. But I haven't got the energy to do it, really.
You did do pretty fucking well in your 30s and 40s already.
Yeah. Yeah. But it was, I mean, sort of, it was. Yeah. I'm going to say it was easier then. I mean, the times were what the times were. And, you know, I certainly never, like I said, I don't think I ever did any of them things that signify selling out. You know, I never, like I say, Comic Relief and all that bullshit. Or, like, you know, Ben did the Royal Command Variety Show, you know, which is pretty, you know, pretty fucking,
I think,
bad.
It's such a sad time, because especially with the power of social media now, I think the people who book talent to do these televised comedy gigs, they're afraid of audiences having a reaction to what's happening. If anyone's too far right wing, there'll be a Twitter storm about propaganda on telly. If anyone's too far left wing, there'll be a Twitter storm about propaganda on telly, like left wing media, right wing media. So they just need people to be down the fucking line, because they're afraid of anyone reacting, like, right, to art. And isn't that the fucking point of art, is that people have a reaction to it? But they're like, no, keep it down the line. The only reaction we want is a laugh. So everything has to be down the fucking middle. And it's so boring. I'd rather see something that makes me angry on television than something that's just like, haha.
Would you go on them? I mean, with the presumably that they haven't asked you yet, would you go on them shows?
Yeah, because I need the money.
Yeah.
You straight
up. Yeah, I suppose that's
it. That's it. You need the money. If you want that paycheck, don't be controversial.
I mean, what I am really pleased about is Sandwich Bar, which is, you know, which is, and Radio 4 have been amazingly supportive about all this. That it is, you know, it's unabashedly left wing, it's unabashedly pro Corbyn, you know, pro socialism. And I've never had any interference. And that's kind of, I'm happy doing that, really, I think. And that'll do me, really. Going out and fighting, you know, doing, like, Mock the Week and Life in the Apollo, I couldn't be arsed with it, really, you know.
Yeah, well, I think that's, and I think you said before how the beauty of radio is it still feels like, I think you said it was like telly in the
80s. Yeah, yeah.
Because, like, with my series, again, similar to yours, it's very much just what I wanted to do. It was just me and my producer and my partner, who helps, like, direct my stand-up stuff.
Right.
Just the three of us going, this is what we want it to be. This is the perspective we want it to be. We want this episode to be from this perspective, you know, from this attitude, this side of the argument, and it's just going to go. It just goes out, and
yeah.
If it was on telly, there'd be someone going, no, you need it to be even more balanced and even more perspective.
Well, I mean, Roger, the compliance guy at Radio 4 is fantastic. You know, he's really, really brilliant. He says, you know, as long as you can justify it, you can say what you want, really. You know, there is balance across the network. You don't have to be balanced yourself. And then Seanad was great. And I think Julia, who's now taken over from Seanad, will be, you know, she's great. I mean, so, you know, she'll be a continuity in that sense, really.
I did have a moment recorded in my second series where there was a joke where I called Dominic Raab a cunt.
Right.
And my producer said, yeah, but you have to be able to prove it. And I was like, I think I could prove it. I don't think I'll make the edit, though, to be honest.
They didn't let you do it. Because of weight. I mean, they do have a certain...
No, yeah, they're very...
Restriction on weight. I mean, they're not bad. They're pretty okay, but they won't...
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, fucking cunt, I think, don't really... You know, it's outside there. And that's just the deal, really.
It's a mix of stand-up and voiceover, your show, right?
Well, it's mainly stand-up, but there's also, like, little sketchy bits and interviews because it's... I mean, a lot of it is about my family, so I like to have... I've got my dad in it and my mum's in it. Okay. And I think it just gives it a real personal feel and it makes the stories about my dad and my mum kind of more real. And I just it gives it a nice... And I just, you know, I don't want to just do just stand-up. I kind of like, well, I want to try and show I can do other stuff as well because, you know, that's the whole point of having your own thing, isn't it? And also, generally, when I was chatting to my producer about what we wanted to do, and one of the main kind of bases of series we based it on was Sandwich Bar. The way it does, you know, it's not just stand-up. You've got the bit at the start where it's you walk into the Sandwich Bar and other little bits there, and it just gives it a really nice feel that's its own. It isn't just a Radio 4 stand-up show, and that's what's really lovely about it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, no, I mean, I'm very pleased with that show. I mean, it's sort of because it's. I mean, sometimes I sort of think. I mean, it won Best Audio Award, I think, for whatever it was. But I mean, it in a way, it's funny because stuff on Radio 4 goes out to like. I mean, I think Sandwich Bar is like 4 million listeners or something. You know, once it's aggregated, but you know, but like no fucker ever, no fucking what's she. Nobody ever reviews it or anything. You know, it's a bit annoying in that sense.
Well,
right?
I think it's very good.
Thank you. Well, I think your show is very good too.
So when does series 2 of Tom Mayhew Benefit Scum come out?
July 13th, I believe, is the first one. And then it's on for 4 weeks. So, yeah.
We're going to be on Radio 4 at the same time because Strangers on a Train starts going out on July 10th.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, I think it's really... I'd say it's either... It's either going to revolutionise radio as we know it, or it's going to be like really boring. I'm not sure which. Really, it's it's. I've never done something where you're making up the show as you do it. Really, it was the most extraordinary
it's fucking
challenge.
Cool.
You think
it's
all right?
A really cool format.
Yeah,
and both your shows are going to do great.
Thank you.
I can feel it in my bones.
One thing I liked that I saw on YouTube, it was a chat with you on an Australian thing called Studio 10.
Yeah.
And there's a really nice bit at the start of it where they go, oh, Alexi, show the people what you've been doodling. And you go a bit sort of coy and you go, oh, just did this picture. And you've drawn a gun and a cat next to it.
Really?
And they go, oh, Alexi, what is that? And it's like a teacher talking to a little student. And you're like, oh, it's just an AK-47, John. And it's really, really sweet having heard you talk about it on the podcast. And this was from, like, 2016. And it's a really... I mean, today I might be able to put the audio in, but it's a very...
It's
just a very funny thing.
I've seen it on YouTube. I haven't watched it, but I should look,
You as a grown man in his 60s just going, yeah, I'm just doing some doodling when I'm supposed to be at work.
A gun and a cat, that does sort of sum up my, my interests.
It's a lovely clip.
So our guest host this morning is acclaimed comedian, actor and writer Alexi Sale. We've really been getting to know you this morning, which has been great.
Yeah.
And I think it's time, I think I want to show everyone your doodle, if that's all right.
Okay.
Can you get a close-up of this doodle here? What have you been?
That's an AK 74, the later model in the 5.54 millimeter.
Of course.
Why are you doing this on?
My mum wouldn't let me have toy guns when I was. There's a cat as well. When I my mum wouldn't let me have toy guns, and so what I used to do was I used to make my own gun out of bread. Like I used to eat like a slice of bread in an L shape, and then run around the streets going. Like that. And I was fine as long as it didn't rain. but then my gun had melt. And so it's given me a lifelong fascination with firearms. Typical reverse psychology. No.
Your parents were communists, obviously, yeah. and peaceniks. Or...
They had this weird combination of kind of hippie ideals and... they were in CND, they were in Ban the Bomb, except... Yeah. For the Russians, they wanted the Russians to have the bomb. Nobody else, you know. But they were a weird mixture of kind of hippie ideas and yeah. ruthless, you know, Marxism. It's very strange.
I know the feeling.
We all know and love you as well.
Oh, yeah. The last thing was just like. Because in the proper early days, you released a video and some stand up specials, right? And do you think you'd ever do any more? Like, because obviously your style has changed so much and. I think it's more like a classic sort of special. And I mean, similar to the music, but I guess even more so, I think it would be a shame to not have a proper, nice film to next year's sales.
Yeah, special. It's funny, isn't it? Again, because, I mean, it is, I you know, I mean, the 2020 show, which was fucking fantastic. I mean, really, there was a couple of reviews, Guardian and the Times, so both said it's like a really, truly amazing show. And then in his memoir, I mean, his sort of, you know, roundup of the year, Brian Logan said that was the best stand-up he saw in 2020. There wasn't any stand-up in 20, but of the stand-up that he saw, he said that was the best. It was a fucking amazing show. I didn't even record it, like, audio. I didn't even... When the tour got cancelled and then I got COVID, but I think right after I got COVID, I wrote down the show, what I could remember of it. And that's the only record that exists of that amazing tour that I did in 2020.
And you've used most of that for Sandwich Bar.
And I'm using it in Sandwich Bar. Yeah, so it'll be, you know, it'll be memorialised in that way, but there's no record of that show apart from some words I wrote down on a pad. Not mad. It's really stupid, isn't it, really?
Well, unless there are some comedy nerds I know who, when they go see a stand-up show, they record it on their phone.
Right.
Which is technically probably naughty and maybe illegal, I don't know. But if there's an Alexi Sell obsessive that did that, they might be able to send you the audio.
Sure. Yeah, well, I wouldn't mind the audio. Yeah, I think, well, maybe they, yeah, I suppose they might record the audio, yeah.
Email us at alexisellpodcast@gmail.com.
Because I think even if it is used in Sandwich Bar, I think just the idea of having the proper show as a stand-up show, which is a different format, the visual format.
Yeah. I've only been back doing stand-up, I suppose, since like 2011, 2012. So that's what was 10 years now, I suppose, but very intermittently. You know, and obviously people have, vaguely raised the possibility of doing a special, you know, for Netflix or whatever. And I've never really been interested in it. I mean, I think if I ever did another show, I would probably make sure it was recorded.
It would be nice to have it for record, you know, for the sake of record, just to have a nicely shot. Yeah, everything of yours is like, you know, VHS quality.
Yeah, and it was very funny. The one... live recording I did, which is a VHS, and we recorded it at Band on the Wall in Manchester, I think. And I also wanted it to look all grainy.
which
was some useless guy that did it. He was a friend of my then manager, I think. I don't know. It just looks terrible. But also the manager was a tremendous arsehole who ended up suing me. Because it was the Alexi Sell pirate video. He wanted it to be not in a box, but he wanted it to be in a paper bag. So we distributed it in a paper bag, but this was in the days of video stores.
Yeah.
It would fall off the shelves because it was in a paper bag.
Yeah.
So I was sending out this video that was it that fell off the shelves, so it didn't really sell a lot of copies.
Jesus Christ.
But this, I think that's on the internet, isn't it, somewhere?
What about redoing, learning, and then re-performing CAC? And, like, maybe updating it a little, but, like, doing it again, recording
like,
it in HD.
That'd be like, yeah, that'd be like performance art, wouldn't it? Because it wouldn't be real. I think probably that is not, you know.
There's a new app called Next Up Comedy. Are you on there?
No, I'm filming a special with them in September.
So they're like Netflix, but just for stand-up comedy.
Right.
And you sign up to a monthly subscription. Like, they would, in a heartbeat, commission a show for you on there or something.
I'd have to have a show there, wouldn't I?
Yeah, so, yeah, maybe.
Well, they did tell me they need another act for September. If you want to do a show at the Frog and Bucket.
Do you think I could get... You have to be really good to get on there.
Oh, shut up. Oi, put my name in the hat. I'm about to have a set on there. I'd love to go.
Do you know Phil Ellis?
Yeah.
I was having a drink with Phil the other night, and he said that the boy who did support for me, Phil Brush, Peter Brush.
Peter Brush, yeah.
Yeah, is now like a headliner. He's really come on.
Yeah.
And that's the Alexi effect.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah, so he was my support. I said, well, if he's got really good now, there's no fucking way he's supporting me anymore. Because I don't want the competition. Mm. You've given me lots to think about there.
Well, there we go. I think what I love about this podcast is that everyone's different. Every episode's different. Every guest brings different stuff to it.
Yeah.
And it's... you know, constantly evolving and changing.
Yeah, yeah.
Opening different avenues and, you know, that's fucking exciting.
Tom, thank you very much for talking to me.
That's all right. Thank you for having me.
Ah, well, it's been a pleasure, really. I think I'm probably, as you know, with so many of these things, really, I feel like we've only scratched the surface of what we could talk about, really. But that'll do for now. You've been listening to the Alexis L podcast, produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Anthony Overton for the sound engineering, and to Audio Boom for hosting us. And don't forget, you can support the show by signing up to our Patreon, which is patreon.com/AlexisL podcast. All right, thank you. Bye.